The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Get ultimate protection and durability for your painting project at Menards. Get a paint that combines durability and gorgeous color. Dutch Boy's DuraClean Interior Paint and Primer in 1 offers Stay Clean technology, making your home stay beautiful and clean longer. And with Dutch Boy's easy opening smooth pouring container, transforming your home has never been easier. Save big money on Dutch Boy paints and head into Menards to get your paint project started today.
Save big money at Menards.
HuntStand is the most popular and functional mobile hunting app on the market. With a variety of base maps to choose from, satellite imagery that is updated every month, the ability to check the weather, know property information, and even catalog your trail cam pics, HuntStand even gives you the ability to import pins and location markers from other mobile apps. Visit HuntStand.com or download wherever you download your apps. Enter discount code SN20 at checkout for 20% off.
Heyo, back. Western Rookie, episode 56. How's it going, man?
Yes, sir. Dude, it's going.
Yeah?
I'm excited, man. It's going to be a good episode. I just, there's something about looking forward to Western hunts while you're in, like, the draw season or the application season. I don't know if it's just that extra element of, like, I might be able to draw something awesome this year. Or what, but it's going to be a good episode.
Yeah, and it's also in the middle of shed season. Like, shed season's here, so it's like you're applying for Western hunts, you're talking about the fall, you're getting excited to get out and find some antlers. I just got all my shed season swag from Dwayne.
Yes, sir.
So rocking the new hat. It came with this soft side tape that's retractable. I've been using these, like, 10-foot Taylor's tapes, and so every time I score a shed, I got to wrap up 10-foot tape. So I'm super excited for this. And then get this, it comes with the backside of it's actually centimeters. And so I'm going to play some jokes on social media and, like, score some sheds with the centimeter side and be like,
oh, dude, that'd be killer.
Oh, dude, the 156-inch buck here. And everyone's just going to blow their gaskets.
They're going to lose their minds, man. My son has, I think, confiscated all of those tape measures. Those are his favorite toys to play with.
Oh.
He just retracts them, lets them go. Retracts, or, like, pulls them out.
Dude,
retracts them.
This is the
OG
one.
And he swings them around. Dude, those OG ones, they're durable. They work, but they are so annoying when they come unraveled.
Yeah, and I've scored so many antlers with this one. I lost the metal end to it. So I'm definitely overdue for a new one.
Yep. Hey, at least you got that new soft retractable one.
Oh yeah, yeah. Shed season. Got to get your shed season swag.
Heck yeah, man.
I don't know, dude, if Ryan's a big shed hunter. Our guest tonight, Ryan Steig, I don't think he's as big into the sheds as he is into just, like, a Western deer killer.
He likes to collect sheds on full bodies.
Yeah, yeah. He doesn't want the participation trophy. He just wants first place.
He wants first place every time.
Yeah, dude.
I mean, from everything you've told me about him, he is a top qualifier quite a bit.
Well, and get this, we hired him in my group at work as an intern, and it's very corporate America type company, and so you never really know how much you should, like, really talk about your, you know, firearm and hunting stuff on the first day.
Yep.
And by the end of the first week, man, we were talking, like, tags and strategies and units, and, like, it just happens to be we're both on the same wavelength.
Nice. Yeah. Dude, when you can find somebody like that at work, it makes everything so much better. I've worked in a lot of, like, all men fields and positions, and it's insane to me when I'm working with, like, seven other dudes and I can't find a single, like, outdoorsman among the bunch. That drives me nuts. I'm like, none of you even like to fish? Oh, well, I took my kid fishing last summer. And I'm like, no, that's not what I meant. Like,
one time.
Yeah. Going one time last summer is not, that does not qualify you as a fisherman.
Yeah, exactly. And you never know who you're going to like get. Like you can't really choose your coworkers either. Like you can't choose your family, can't choose your coworkers very easily. And so you're like, I'm stuck with this dude that just talks
unless about. You got to start your own business, man.
Yeah, then start your own business. Yeah, then you can choose. You're going to be the only coworker for a while, but yeah. So,
dude, on the shed topic, I found my first shed of the year.
I was just going to bring that up. You sent me a picture of it. I don't think we've talked about it on the podcast. It was a good shed, too. It was last year's, right? Last year's shed?
Last year's shed, the entire brow tine had been chewed off, and it had been chewed all the way through. Actually, I think I've got it. It's in a backpack in this room somewhere. It chewed like halfway through the main beam also.
Oh, damn.
So it's like, I mean, if I bent it a little too hard, it would probably snap off. But dude, I didn't put on a ton of miles on foot. I just checked a couple really good spots where I was like, there's got to be one in here. I'd never shed hunted these spots before. And then about, I don't know, 37 acres of beans, but it's like a rolling hill with beans, obviously all cut. I was like, you know what? I'm just going to drive up and down this on the four wheeler and look for sheds. And there's two seasonal ponds that are just all overgrown and nasty and look like great bedding area. And I was driving around one of those and I looked down and this thing was glowing. I mean, as close to a beam coming through the cloud as you can get. That, I mean, it was just like right there in front of me. So
it's something about like ponds and water sources, you know, up here, they're froze solid, but it must be like when things are starting to warm up, those deer looking for water. Cause I find sheds on ponds and water sources and like, and you know, berms every single year. I can't walk past one anymore. I've found so many, like you have to go check it out. There's something about those sheds. And I actually just saw the reel today. And I remember, what was it? Episode 53. We were talking about you bought a farm and you were checking out the neighbors and then you got permission on like two new farms. Was it one of those farms you got permission on?
No, so this is a farm that I've had permission on longer than I've lived out there, actually. I mean, even the first time, because I used to live about a mile from where we just bought land.
Mm.
And I've had permission on this property for probably 8 years now, but I haven't done a ton with it. You know, like I know there's other neighbors that actually hunt that same property. The guy was super open to letting people come and hunt his land. He never said no to anybody. And so I've kind of been like, hey, listen, I'm not going to stir the pot. I've got other land out here I can hunt. So I've kind of stayed away from it. But shed season, I'm like, dude, I'm just going to cruise over there. I've got trail cameras up. Honestly, I'm going to talk to the neighbors and not give too much away. But the biggest buck I have ever had on trail camera was on that property. And I was really hoping that I would find his sheds because I don't know how big they're going to be. I'm hoping for like a 70 inch side.
Dude, 70's big. That's a sweet antler.
Here's the deal. I've never scored a shed. I've only scored a couple bucks in my entire life.
Yeah.
But this one buck, man, he has a brow tine that is longer than his G2, and his G2 comes up and forks.
Oof. Yeah, that's pretty good. I mean, this one that I showed you earlier from this season, I just scored it with my new shed season soft side tape. And this one is like 62, but he's tight. Like you can tell he's kind of tight. He doesn't have a very long beam. But you can kind of start to picture like a 70 inch antler, man, you're talking about like a stud buck. You're 155 right off the bat, like a 155 caliber buck. If he's tight, if he's wide, you're talking 160.
So I'm going to show you this on here. I don't know if I sent this to you. This is the buck. Look at that.
Oh yeah.
Brow tine.
That's probably a 70 inch antler. Does he have a G4? Is that his
beam?
Yeah,
he does.
Okay.
No, that's a G4. His beam cuts in.
Yeah.
Right in that picture, it looks like it's cut off, but he's got it. And like I said, I've never scored a shed before, but I was just thinking like, dude, that's got to be probably close to 70 inches.
We got
to
hook you up. Well, ironically, all of those sheds on my top wire behind me, none of them crack 70. Yeah. I have the world record for the number of 67-inch four-point sheds. There's like five of them on that wall that are all 66, 67, 68-inch four-point sides.
What would you do if I go out and like my third shed, my third whitetail shed ever found was a 70-inch side?
Dude, I'd give it to you because I'm batting a 315 average on bull elk.
Yeah, yeah, all right. No, okay, and you got me on that.
You can't have all the love, right? So I'd give you that one. I'll give not you all. That. No, it would be cool. It would be cool. I have some buddies that I met shed hunting, and they're from Northeast Iowa, and his brother found a clean 5.90 inch side last year.
Oh my god!
Yeah, like literal 200 inch caliber buck, and just insane. They're just shed hunting fools. Between him and his brother, they find like knocking on 250 sheds a year, whitetail sheds.
Jeez, dude. Yeah, I don't think I know. Well, I mean, I know you and I know a couple other guys who find a lot of sheds, but I think in like my, in a very, very large friend group that I've got, I don't think all of us combined would add up to 250 sheds. Like,
that's a lot. That's most, a lot of bone.
Yeah. I mean, I'm talking like over the course of our entire lives, most of the guys love to hunt. They absolutely love to hunt. Obviously, if they find an antler, they're going to pick it up. But I think for the most part, none of them go out specifically for sheds. And honestly, I hadn't really done a lot of that.
Until I started sending you picture after picture last year. I was just baiting you.
Until I saw your social media and I was like, this idiot can't even see the one that's right behind me. I got to go out and pick these up. They're everywhere.
Dude, I get so much slack online for that. It's just all fun. It's all pure fun, but. Well, I see Ryan popped into the lobby. Let's get him in here and kick this episode off. What do you say?
Sounds good, man.
Awesome.
You're listening to The Western Rookie, a hunting podcast full of tips, tricks, and strategies from seasoned Western hunters. There are plenty of opportunities out there. We just need to learn how to take on the challenges.
Hunting is completely different up there.
That part's 26 big game animals.
You can fool their eyes, but you can't fool their nose.
300 yards back to the road turned into 3 miles back the other way.
It's always cool seeing new hunters go and harvest an animal.
I don't know what to expect.
If there's anybody I want in the woods with me, it'll be you.
Hey, guys.
Yeah. How's it going?
Oh. Hey, what's going on, man?
Doing good. Doing good.
So Ryan, this is Dan Ryan. Ryan and I work together, and Dan is the current, he was the co-host, invited me on to be co-host with him, so.
Sure, yeah, I started following some of you guys' stuff, so listened to a few podcasts, had a couple long drives this weekend, so.
Nice.
Kind of got the gist of it, so.
Nice. So Dan, Ryan is... He's a flatlander.
I really like this guy with the sheds in the background.
Yeah. You gotta have your street cred showing over your shoulder, right?
Yeah, some of it. I did that for a reason. I got some lessons, I guess, to teach about deer like that behind me. So we'll get into that.
Nice.
So
yeah, Ryan's a flatlander like me. Grew up in Minnesota and then got the bug for the West and has been just grinding the last couple of years.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's been exciting, man.
Dude, that's awesome, man.
Yeah, Ryan got hired on as like a part-time student in my group, and then it just so happens that he was like a huge hunter too. So I'm like, oh, sweet, finally someone in my group that like gets it, you know? Like, what'd you do this weekend? Oh, yeah. We did hockey and we did baseball, and then Ryan's over there like, yeah, I went out west and shot like 80 honkers, like.
Yeah, exactly. It's, I mean, you're almost BSing your way through. Talking to other coworkers, and then it's like you find the few that hunt, and it's like, okay, here we go. Let's have some good convo. So
yeah,
it's no longer small talk. It's actually like, this is what we're into.
Yeah. Basically, like, I think it was like after week one, I was like, so are you hunting in like this unit out west or that? You know, like, we're talking about like trying to figure out how to get these back in North Dakota, how to draw a buck tag without burning your mule deer points, because you have to, it's just deer points. Like, you can't do like a mule deer versus a whitetail. So you don't really want to burn your deer points just to go shoot a whitetail when there's muleys on the table, but it takes like 3-4 years to draw a muley. So you want to like, we're trying to figure out like, hey, you think this unit would be better to get like a second chance whitetail buck? But and then it's like, yeah, but there's like no public in that unit.
Yeah. Yeah. North Dakota's tricky, but if you willing to travel, I mean, it's a great state for as a resident.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're pulling a tag every year if you really want it.
Yeah. Especially for archery. Dude, was it last year, Ryan, or the year before you shot 3 whitetails in 2 states in 2 days?
Last year.
Yeah.
Last year I was whitetail heavy. Yeah. Bunch of western whitetails. I ended up shooting like 3 whitetails west of the Missouri, so.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds tough. I can tell you sound very upset about that. Yeah, I was very whitetail heavy. I just shot like 3 bucks. No big deal.
Yeah. Yeah, that western whitetail, I mean, a few people touch on it, but not many. It's totally underrated in the West. It gets you out there a lot easier than anything else. It's a fun time.
And it's so much more, I think it's more fun western whitetail hunting than eastern whitetail hunting sometimes. Because you're just out west, you're seeing game. It's like, there's a buck I want to shoot. You just like, walk over there, go shoot it. Like,
yeah. It's totally different. It's a totally different game. You know, all the same strategies that she's using for muleys and elk. Deciphering terrain is definitely a huge part of it. Whereas out east, it's talking about, you know, where is their food? Where is their bedding? Well, out in the open prairie and stuff, it's like it is so hard to even tell what's the best bedding and food. It's like they're eating, you know, not much. Or weird food sources that an Eastern wouldn't understand. So it's all about covering ground and glassing. So just like you would muleys and elk. So
yeah,
it's fun.
I think, Ryan, I think you and I first trip was like the exact same as Dan and my first hunt together, like a disaster train of a shed hunt.
Yeah.
I remember Ryan and I, we left, what did we leave Fargo? Like 3 in the morning, drove across the entire state to go find some mule deer sheds, not knowing thing. And I had a buddy from Alec with me, and we just like threw a dart at the map, go out there. Turns out muleys don't shed in early February. So we just like drove around and looked for coyotes the whole weekend and did a couple short walks, and everywhere we walked, we saw like muley bucks holding, and none of them were even big. So it's kind of a disaster train of a first shed hunt.
Yeah. I think we covered our ground by saying that it was a shed scouting trip.
And then we never went back.
Yeah.
Which is basically kind of a similar first hunt that I brought Dan. Well, Dan technically brought me on, but I was supposed to like come in and be like shed hunting counselor, like, you know, guidance on what we should do and how to find a bunch of sheds. And it kind of went equally as bad on my end. Dan found one, but.
Yeah.
But yeah, exactly. To your credit, I mean, it wasn't a lot of property. We had a couple small chunks. Most of it, though. At that time of year, they're hanging out in cover. All the crop fields are cut. I mean, we've never really gone out there and done it. And honestly, we didn't even find a shed except for on the neighbor's property, who we didn't initially have permission for.
Yeah.
We got permission for that and then went over there, and that's the only spot that had one.
Yeah. Meanwhile, I was like as sick as a dog, you know, blue in the gills, bent over, you know, emptying my stomach, and Dan's over there. I found one. So
what state was that in?
That was Wisconsin. We met Wisconsin. In Wisconsin. Yeah. Dan grew up in Wisconsin. So we had some family ties and some family land. We met up for a quick one, but,
sure.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about your season last year. Cause you also did some elk hunting. I really regret how elk season turned out for me and my brother, and we'll get into that a little bit, but yeah, give us the lowdown on how you went about your elk season, especially last year, because you kind of did the same, threw a pin at the map and had success.
Sure. Yeah, in general had a heck of a season last year, but I guess for elk specifically, you know, got the Montana General, and I got to start with archery, because we did go archery, and absolutely going to call that a success, even though I wasn't the one that killed a bull. But yeah, we went out for archery elk, and our first day, I actually drove through the night. We do that a lot. I don't know why, but got to the trailhead at like, 5:30 in the morning, and we're off on our way by 6:30. And I mean, essentially we found our bull by 8:30, had him dead by 9:30. And that was such a sweet hunt even for me, because I was behind the call. I love calling whatever it comes to, I mean, elk, turkeys, ducks, whatever. So that was a blast for me. So that was first archery elk success that I've had, was this year, and that was a heck of a hunt. On my Instagram, you can even see the video. We had three guys there, so a shooter, a videoer, and then I was back behind calling. And I mean, that's, if you haven't done the classic call in for elk, there is nothing better than that, to be interacting. Oh,
and Ryan's too humble to say it was also a toad. It was a big bull.
Yeah, it was a nice bull.
It was,
for sure.
Did you guys ever end up scoring that bull? It was on the other side of 300 for sure.
I gotta ask him again if he ended up scoring it, but a solid bull for Montana general. I mean, let's be honest, for archery Montana,
for driving through the night, brand new unit,
yeah,
have the bull dead by lunch first day.
Yep, that's not an easy thing to do.
Dan's like, sign me up. Units.
Yeah.
Dude, for real, man, I would take that any day. I mean, going into that, what was your favorite type of hunting, and leaving that hunt become your favorite type of hunting?
Yeah, you're kind of cutting out there, Dan, but I think you were saying, like, before that was the favorite. I mean, you can't beat muleys out west. Really can't. I thoroughly enjoy that, but so it's probably his second trip I've taken for archery elk. So I mean, that's got to be up there now, especially after getting some success. But you really can't beat that.
Yeah, and like you said right before, there's something different about calling those things in. I mean, obviously the shooter was close, but were you close enough that when you like bugles back, your chest rattles?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I was, positioned back, 30 or so yards, out of sight. And I mean, shooter, the shot was 7 yards. So we're talking, I mean, if I was in view, I could have shot the elk type thing. So yeah, there's nothing better than just slowly hearing that progression coming towards you, from a distance. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, that's, you're going to get like a, you're going to get an unrealistic view of it.
I've got to try that at some point.
Yeah, I've been trying to convince Dan to archery elk hunt for, was it 2 years now, Dan? And you're like, I like love my rifle group. I love going with those guys, and just, we put them down every year. But, to hear like, man, you're like, Ryan's hunt is just the dream. Like, they come into you, setup's perfect.
But there's other states.
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't have to all be in Colorado.
There's other states that we can hunt, man. I mean, for real. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But what Ryan was also too humble to mention is that him and I were talking about doing because our group got split and Ryan was trying to get out as well. And so we briefly talked about maybe doing like all four of us together. And my brother was like, I don't know about bringing someone new. Like, I trust, Ryan, that's fine, but I don't know the fourth guy, and, I don't know how this is going to all shake out, and our normal group's already pretty big, so, if it's all the same to you, I'd kind of rather just go our own way. And so I broke the bad news to Ryan, and then day one, I'm sitting on the mountain, and there's Ryan and his buddy with this huge bull on the ground already, and I showed it to my brother. I was like, this was the guy we were going to go with, by the way.
Yeah. And, to be honest, when you're talking about doing stuff like that or joining up with groups, I mean, I was trying to push where we ended up going. Like, if we were to go together, I still would have been saying, I think we should go here. But because, I mean, it wasn't such a dart at the map. I mean, there's a lot of preparation that goes into that, and scouting, e-scouting.
Yeah.
So I was, confident in the spot. I think sometimes it's nice to have, two two groups going out, in a, from a particular camp, especially when you're talking about big game that are staged at different elevations. You can get out those first couple of days and have, a couple different experiences, and then you come back to camp and you share that and say, well, I didn't see anything at, 6,000, in the other group. It was like, there's plenty of bugling at 8. So, that can be helpful, and just camaraderie at camp. So, don't mind.
So you're saying that you need more people to come out and help out and scout and look at different elevations. That's all I got out of that whole statement.
Muffled out the rest. Yeah, exactly. I mean, archery elk isn't for everybody. It's not one of those things where everybody is, they say they're down to go, but it's not always easy to convince them. So when you find the people that are in for it, yeah.
Well, Dan and I had a podcast guest just a couple of weeks ago, and oh my gosh, I mean, that wasn't even archery, but that Dan probably knows the story better than me. But it's not all roses. So, it's hard to pick a good partner. I mean, I don't know if you want to share some of that by episode. Was it 53, Dan?
Yeah, I think that's what it was. And he went out there and got a guy. Well, the guy invited him, actually. And then they get out there, and the guy didn't really want to do any work. He said he couldn't haul meat in his pack at all.
Yeah, he's like, this pack don't haul
meat. What are you doing? Like, I'm trying to go after it. Yeah, this pack don't haul meat. And yeah, I don't understand. I mean, he was still able to get it done, which is awesome, but I can't imagine being in the backcountry, getting a bull down, and then like, oh, hey, just a heads up, I'm not helping pack meat out.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially for an elk hunt. I mean, meat moving is one of the bigger concerns on an elk hunt. I mean, you can get away with some other stuff for deer, but
yeah, you need to be all in. Dan's the guy in the camp that shoots the bulls in his Colorado group where everyone tells him not to go.
Yeah. I think I heard about that in the podcast I listened to from you guys. So
yeah, that's 100% accurate.
He's got that selective hearing. Like they say like, yeah, there's elk in there, but don't go shoot one. And his ears just turn off after there's elk in there.
Exactly.
Sometimes it's nice to have extra guys in camp to find different elk. And Dan's like, whoa, that was an invitation.
We got to take a step back. It's not selective hearing. I 100% heard exactly what he said. It was blunt disobedience. That's what you call that, not selective hearing.
As he should, honestly. Nope. I mean, if you got the ambition to get there and get it down, I'm a true believer of you'll find a way. Find a way to get it back out.
I've never thought about it before I pulled the trigger or my brother. I mean, me and my brother talk about this all the time. Like, we never think about it when there's an elk at 40 yards or with me and my rifle and there's an elk in my scope. Like, I don't think about how bad the pack out's going to be.
Yep. You'll find a way.
No, you can't. You second guess that, and all of a sudden the opportunity is gone. Especially with a bow, I'm assuming. Like, the odds of you having a elk in range long enough for you to have that conversation and think like, hey, should we do this right here? By that point, the shot window is gone. I mean, it's moved through the pines or the cedars or whatever you're hunting in. And well, there you go. Now the elk made up your decision for you.
Yeah.
Well, can you imagine at 7 yards, like Ryan's buddy, Ryan called him into 7 yards for the guy. Like, there's zero time. Like, you have to be at full draw by the time he pops into your window.
Yeah, exactly. It's a sound game at that point. You're waiting to, as you know, trusting your ears for when to draw. You know, that's a crazy concept.
Did he hit it frontal then at 7 yards?
Yep. Frontal shot came square in. And that's a good thing about calling. I mean, it's like, you got to always keep your shooter in the middle and stuff. So it's like, I couldn't have been more proud of, having the frontal right at the shooter. You know, that's what everyone's going for. So
yeah, at 7 yards, I mean, you got a 12-inch circle to hit.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. As long as you got a good backdrop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you ever done one with a bow though? Or do you do them?
I've done front on shots on a couple deer so far.
Yeah.
And then I think I've taken one front on shot on a deer with a rifle, and then my first elk was a hard quartering too, with my rifle.
Yeah.
And so I put it just inside the shoulder.
Yeah. Yeah. It is a deadly shot. I mean, I think it's inside like 20 or whatever your comfort, like your extreme comfort range is. I mean, it's an open window, right, to all the good stuff. I mean, you can cut the, you cut the carotid, you cut the windpipe, you can split the lungs, hit the heart, all with the same arrow. Like, it is, man, that is a deadly, deadly shot.
Yeah. Yeah. I think with elk, the big thing is it's all about distance and alertness. You know, an elk, especially when they're frontal on you, it's not like a deer. They don't drop, you know, like a eastern whitetail. They're going to make a turn. You know, if they don't like something or they see you, they're going to make a turn left or right. So it's all about the time it takes for your arrow to get to them on a frontal. You know, I wouldn't encourage, even if you got them lined up, you know, past 30 yards, it's just too much time. You know, if they react to it and turn, you know, then it becomes an issue. But like you were saying, Brian, absolutely a super deadly shot if you hit your spot.
So when you, what made you start going west? I mean, growing up like me in Montana, did you have like siblings that had already done it? Cause that's my story. My brother and my dad had already started going west. What got you looking towards the horizon?
Yeah, none of that. You know, dad got me into waterfowl hunting, you know, some deer and turkey type stuff. But as for out west, I mean, I got my dad on his first muley and antelope. So, you know, I've kind of taken over that. But what it really was moving to North Dakota and that archery tag that we can get.
Oh, yeah.
So as residents, we can get an archery tag that's good for any one deer, muley, whitetail, whatever. And so as soon as I came up here for college in North Dakota, immediately started thinking about the Badlands and having, you know, the first opportunity at mule deer out there. And that is 100% where it started. You know, when you can go out there and absolutely embarrass yourself for, you know, as a youngin for a couple of years and learn so much about muleys, I owe a lot to that hunt for sure. You learn a ton, and with a bow, you're bound to get disappointed and have to learn from those experiences. So
is it just a one deer tag period, or just one with your bow?
One with your bow. Yeah. So you get every year you get your bow tag. So I mean, I'm buying that every year, and then you can apply for your rifle tag. So. And that's kind of what I was saying before. Like, if you really want a rifle buck tag and you're willing to travel, you can get one in North Dakota. So usually, you know, every year I'm ended up with two deer tags.
Yeah. And there's definitely some sleeper units out west. So you can, like, you can build your mule deer points and then on the second draw, get a whitetail buck instead. Because everyone wants the muleys in those western units, and there's some stud whitetails out there, and you know you're really playing the fringe game between like private public. You know, some of it's broken country. It's none of them are ideal whitetail units, but like
not at all.
Like right, like you're looking at this whole map of I don't know how many square miles, but it's this entire unit, and you got like two half decent 480 pieces, and like a couple like really bad 160s, and you're just like trying to find these rutting bucks just covering ground and crossing public.
Yeah. And the whitetail habitat is not good. I mean, if you were to take a chunk of some of these western, like a section of western stuff, and just transplant it to the east and it was public, no one would hunt it if they looked at the map. I mean, it doesn't look at all like whitetail habitat, but then you get out there and they're acting different. Like I've had those second choice tags a couple of times, and I've shot bucks where the pronghorn should roam for sure. I mean, it is open prairie and they are bedded in stuff that an eastern wouldn't get caught dead in.
Yeah. Well, last year that was your tag.
I mean, they've got to be covering a ton of ground then every day. I mean, if they don't have any cover.
Yeah, yeah, they're not afraid to cover ground, and they're also, I mean, they're using the terrain a lot more. I mean, these nooks and crannies that you'll find them in, it's like you'd think you would find everything or be able to glass up everything, but they know, you know, they know the nooks and crannies that they can fit into and stay out of sight for sure.
Yeah, I remember the one second draw tag I had. I think I'm going to see, these look like good spots. I'm going to sit here for the morning. Didn't see a single deer. And like what I thought was good Western whitetail habitat. So then I just started driving, just putting on miles, checking out different publics. And eventually I ran right across the road. I looked down at Onyx. I'm like, oh, hey, by the way, that's public. Flip the truck around, back up, get out, do the stock and shot it, you know, 300 yards from the road. I mean, like you're like, it's just, you know, I grew up with like access to 650 acres of family land in the heart of whitetail country in Minnesota. And so like you think about like food sources, woodline edges, swamps, like that's what you look for whitetail. And then you go out west and you're like, there's just like Ryan said, like there's one in the middle of a burnt pasture. Like this pasture's been grazed hard for 3 years straight. And there's your buck.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I had it was not last year, but the year before I had, you know, one of those Western whitetail tags and got out there early and just found the best glassing knob I could find in the entire area and just looked and looked and looked. And I found one group of whitetails and thankfully, and it was a good buck. And I mean, you don't get lucky out there like that too often. And on public again, super lucky, but I don't know, that story is kind of interesting.
Like you're lucky a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. That's definitely a part of it. You know, a killer mindset helps. You got to have that to pull some of these crappy tags. I say crappy, with a heartfelt, I mean, I love them. I love taking those tags, and that's actually why I kind of had the backdrop that I do here. Cause these are all my Euro mounts. You know, I got shoulder mounts and stuff, but I think what makes a good hunter is not being obsessed with drawing the best tags or waiting to draw tags. It is taking the opportunities you have at the hand, and you're going to learn a lot more on a tag that's makes it harder for you, right? So that's been big for me. Take what you can get, learn from it, hunt often instead of waiting. It's a pro tip.
Man, that's good advice. I mean, I think that anybody listening to this needs to really soak that in, because I think a lot of people wait to go out west, or they wait to hunt for mule deer or elk or Western whitetail until they draw that big, like, oh man, I got unit 2 in Colorado. And if you're waiting for that, you're only going to get one or two hunts in your lifetime. Whereas if you can get out there and get the experience, one, it's going to make you more successful once you do draw those trophy units. And two, I mean, there's big animals all over the place. You hear about people randomly shooting a monster in a unit that is not known for it at all.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you got to think about, you know, especially on a, if I'm talking about like some of these North Dakota tags that are easier to get, it is the local residents that are going after these tags a lot of times. So they're not probably going to be, you know, the stiffest competition out there. And that applies to, I think, every state, these overlooked ones by non-residents, just because it's, you know, more broken public or takes more out of the box thinking to put together a hunt plan, keeps out a lot of the non-resident pressure, which, honestly, it seems like it's kind of two different types of pressure. You get, you know, non-resident, resident pressure. And a lot of these units, it's the people that are like you that you kind of got to think around. They're doing the same e-scouting that you're doing, looking at the same maps that you're doing. So if you're willing to think outside of the box and work around boundaries, and get in other people's heads, it certainly can help a lot for your success.
Oh yeah. And like those units you're talking about, the locals are like, commonly the locals are applying for that unit because they live that unit. That's where their family farm is. Like, so they have pretty good hunting. They're not, you know, I've never seen, you know, a local on public land out in some of these, what you would call maybe an access tag. Like, it's a tag that you can get. It's not a trophy tag. It's like an access tag. It allows you to go chase a buck. You're not going, like, there's no pressure. There's no, like, the locals are hunting their 40 or their 160 or their, you know, sometimes it's bigger, but yeah, you pretty much got the place to yourself. Like, and that's the nice thing about hunting, like, those units that you and I hunt, Ryan, is like, you never see anybody chasing whitetail. Sometimes you might find an antelope hunter. You know, one time I ran into a guy looking for elk and I had just had that elk tag. So I'm thinking in the back of my mind, like, dude, you aren't even close to where the elk live in this unit. But it's access tags. Like you said, you're going to become such a better hunter by hunting these access tags year in, year out, the skills that you need to develop and build on to, like, spot and stock a mule deer in some of these badlands open countries, or to spot and stock find a whitetail and then get in close to them in these open, like, real low vegetation, like, units. By the time you draw that limited entry that you might be building in another state, I mean, you're going to be a stone cold killer.
Yeah. Yeah. Not to mention the diversity of the tags that you're going to end up getting. I mean, with the exception of, like, you know, archery hunting the Badlands multiple times every year, I haven't hunted the same unit in any state, no matter the species. It is all about those access tags, different units every time. And it's not by design, it is what it is. And that diversity of having to dig apart such different terrain, different units, different species in every state, there's no better education than that. I mean, having to do that year in and year out, you're gonna learn a lot.
And I would imagine going to these units where the main focus is elk and mule deer, not only is there not a lot of competition, but the guys that you do run into are probably more willing to tell you, hey, I just saw a big whitetail buck down here, because they have no skin in the game. Like, they're not going after it at all.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I mean, that, we all know that's not the case with muleys out in the West, both other hunters and landowners. You know, the mule deer are, you know, somewhat sacred. Or even, you know, that applies to antelope in some places too, antelope and whitetail. Yeah, if you're in a unit where you're hunting not the primo tag, or even like a good elk unit that has mule deer in it, people are looking for the elk and they're willing to share that type of information. So trailheads are a great time to talk to people about that type of thing and get information that they're willing to give, for sure. That's a great point.
You know, I just came up with a sleeper idea for anyone. And so, whenever I'm out west, I always ask, like, hey, what you guys looking for? Because I always want them to answer first, so then I can, like, craft my answer accordingly. And so I just got new plates on my truck, and you can get these custom, like, critical access plates in Minnesota. And so there's, like, a moose, a whitetail, a turkey, blah, blah, blah. Well, all the deer hunters get the deer one, right? Because you're like, oh, I'm a deer hunter, I want the deer plate. I'm like, no. I'm going to get the pheasant plate because it's orange. It looks closer to a North Dakota plate, because a lot of people don't like Minnesota plates out west because there's so many people. Like, imagine you're growing up in your favorite spot, and all of a sudden, year after year, you're seeing more and more plates, and they're pretty much all Washington and Minnesota, because that's just where the populations are when people are traveling.
That's a fact.
And so you start to see these Minnesota plates, like, every public you go to, every spot you used to love to hunt, there's three Minnesota trucks there. You start to, like, develop a little bit of a bad blood relationship with the Minnesota plate. So I'm like, okay, the pheasant plate looks more like North Dakota. And if someone sees my truck, they're probably going to assume I'm pheasant hunting, not deer hunting. So they might talk to me more.
That's a hot tip, man.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a hot tip. So then, like, I'll be like, hey, what you guys looking for? And they're like, oh, we're elk hunting. I'm like, hey, I saw some elk over here. Like, you know, you guys seen any mule deer? And then they're like, you know, so you always ask first, so you can kind of, you don't want to, like, just overshare sometimes, because you never know what kind of guy the person is. Like, they might steal your spot, or they might go steal your elk sheds. Like, you got to ask other people first what they're kind of doing. And then, kind of, if they're, like, stone quiet, you're like, okay, I'm not going to tell this guy much, because he's not telling me anything. Like, you know, it's kind of a quid pro quo.
Exactly. Yep. you give me something, I'll give you something. I mean, there's plenty of that, and you can be mutually beneficial on the trailhead when you're doing those docks, for sure, even if you're hunting the same species. Just depends the type of person you're talking to.
See, I feel like you have to go one step farther and just have a big camera hanging from your chest and have your like have your bow covered somehow and just be like, I'm just trying to get some nature photos. Have you guys seen any big elk? Could you point me in the right direction? I mean, that's straight up dishonest, whereas yours is more, hey, you go first.
Yeah, I'm just playing three-dimensional chess, Dan. You're just trying to get the right information. I'm hunting.
I'm just flipping the chessboard over.
I'm just going to let you think I'm pheasant hunting. I'm wearing blaze orange. I got pheasant plates. You can think what you want. But
there you go.
Such a politician.
Yeah, you got to, modern world, modern problems call for modern solutions. And they're like,
exactly.
You know, Ryan and I hunted the same unit in Southeast Montana. What was that 2 years ago, Ryan, where you guys were off in the breaks, not really seeing what you wanted to see. And then you decided to switch it up and come to the unit that I told you not to come to. And then saw the same thing we saw.
In Southeast Montana. Okay. So to be fair on that, we did go to the breaks area, not to get too specific. And it was good hunting, just didn't see what I wanted. We ended up two of the four shot them. But that Southeast Montana, yeah, I was very aware that right now, I'll give a free tip right now. If you draw the Montana tag, Southeast historically is a great place to go right now. Maybe not. Wouldn't go there. But that was after I had gotten that North Dakota whitetail, and then next day South Dakota whitetail, and then the next day, the Sunday, I decided might as well try Montana because I had all three tags. So I did go there, but it was after I was already in Northwest South Dakota.
Yeah,
so,
he's already like, I got nothing to lose, and
yeah.
But what we saw on that trip, I mean, what we had heard going into Southeast Montana, and this is great for the listeners, like, oh, I Googled Southeast Montana and all the forum guy says it's nuts, right? Bucks mm-hmm. everywhere. Well, that was 15 years ago. Now there's cars everywhere. And, you know, what me and my buddy saw is like, we knew there was going to be pressure, but we worked hard. We knew there's going to be a lot of cars. We knew there's not big bucks, but we weren't looking for big bucks. Like, we were just looking for a nice, like a good 3x3 or 4x4, like the buck behind Ryan on the wall. That would have been, we would have been tickled pink to shoot that deer. Like, even smaller than that, mm-hmm. we would have been happy with. Man, we could hardly find a deer that was 2 years old on public. I mean, it was rough. And every, like, when there would be a piece of public that would have 50 yards crossing a road, like a 50 yards of this road, there's a public corner, four trucks stacked on it every time. And so I'm like,
jeez.
Ryan's like, dude, you know, I'm in the area. What do you think? And I'm like, dude, I would go to the breaks or I would go somewhere else, man. This is rough. This is tough. We finally doubled on like medium-sized mule deer on the last day. And then brought them, you know, packed them out. And then I think, Ryan, you shot your whitetail like 2 days later. But you basically pulled that same trick you were talking about earlier. When everyone else is going for a mule deer, like these western whitetails are kind of sleeper animals out there.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, wasn't having good luck with the mule deer out there. You can definitely tell the population was on a down year. So, yeah, I was like, screw it. I'm going to go start looking for whitetails. So
yeah,
I was I didn't end up shooting on private, but I got on a private piece of land, right before I shot mine. So
yeah, obviously permission land, everyone don't write in with the hate comments.
Yeah. When I say I got private land, it means, yeah. Yeah. Permission. I don't pay. Yeah. If that's what you're getting at, is that I would.
No, just like, yeah, I shot him on private. Just slipped that you like, I don't care if it's private. I just went and trespassed and shot it. Oh. No, like, yeah, we're talking no. Permission land. I know, like, personally, you wouldn't do the pay to hunt. There's a lot of trespass fee, which sounds really bad. I wish they came up with a better name for it, but it's basically like a 1 day lease.
That is a terrible name.
Yeah, I've always thought that.
The trespass fee, like, yeah, you can trespass if you pay a fee. It's like, well, then it's not trespassing. It's permission with a payment, like paid permission.
Like, I am paying to break the law or what?
Yeah. Yeah, 1 week lease or a day lease. But they get expensive. It's like $500 a person, and there's no guarantee that you're gonna do anything, right?
No. Yeah. These days I mean there are very few trespass hunts that would be legitimately worth the money.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody gets this idea, these landowners, and rightfully so. There are guys that are willing to pay it, but those are different type of guys that are paying those fees. And that's what
here's a hot tip, though, for the people who are interested in doing a trespass fee. I went and hunted waterfowl with this group called Infinite Outdoors, and it's a mobile app. They've got actually phenomenal mapping software on their app, but you can do those day leases or those week leases. It connects you straight. It basically, they're the broker between you and the landowner, but they have a team of biologists that go out there and make sure that it's a property that's actually worth hunting on. So I'm talking, they'll fly into places, they'll do bush plane stuff, they'll go out there and sit on a river for waterfowl, they'll go check on turkey and make sure that there's actually a population that can be hunted so that you're not paying a trespass fee and not seeing anything.
That's interesting. Yeah, I think I've heard of that coming around. What state was that in?
So I went to Colorado for that hunt. I think they're in like 14 states now, though.
Okay.
I mean, it kind of sounds like North Dakota's PLOTS program, and I think other states have this, but it's like private land open to sportsmen, and the NDGF biologist will come and tour your property and say like, okay, you got 100 acres here, and this 20 is phenomenal habitat. We're going to pay you $20 an acre. This stuff over here, it's like a, you know, it's a pasture land, not that great of quality. We're going to give you like $2 an acre for that. And then they sum it all up and they pay the landowner, which you're paying, right, in your taxes and your tag fees. So it kind of sounds like a privatized version of that, which is interesting because it opens up more access to hunters.
Yeah, I think North Dakota does a good job of that, like you were saying, Brian, actually assigning, you know, a value to it of how good it is. Because there are definitely some places that I've ran into in the West where it's public or it's walk-in access, but you get in there and it is a putting green from cattle grazing or other things. And, you know, some of those things you can't always tell from the map. And you get in there and it's like, if I was a deer, I wouldn't be here either. And they're paying, the state is paying for it. It's ridiculous.
We did that week we were in Southeast Montana, first morning, we're both excited. And my buddy's like, I'm like, what do you want to shoot? And he's like, I don't know, just like a good mule deer, like a 170. And I'm like, do you know what a 170 looks like? And he's like that deadhead you got behind you. And I'm like, dude, that's a 125 inch mule deer. He's like, oh, I'd be happy with that. And I'm like, okay, good. I'm glad we got our expectations on the same page because you're not finding a 170 very easily in Southeast Montana. But we go to this BMA like you're talking about, Ryan, and there was a fire the year before and not a lot of it had grown back yet because it was a drought. So like fire with a drought is just not a good combination. That's not the burn area that all the experts out west say like, oh, burn areas are great. Go hunt like the fringes of a burn. All this regrowth and feed. Well, if there's a drought, like a 5-year drought, like Southeast Montana's had, you're not getting any regrowth. It's just a bunch of black trees. And then it was burnt from cattle grazing and the drought. And my buddy sees a buck. It was a 3x4, probably 120 to 130 inch mule deer, like literally 30 minutes into the first walk. And I'm like, oh my God, this might actually work. Like we might actually kill a deer on the first day. And he looks at it at like 250 yards in the scope and decides not to shoot it because it wasn't quite what he wanted. And for the rest of the week, regretted it. It was, we didn't see another buck on public until the last day.
Yeah, I believe it. I mean, a great tip is too many people look at forums and it's like, yeah, you can get some good ideas, especially from the years that people actually used to use forums and give good info on them. But it's all about relevancy, time relevancy too.
Yeah.
You know, look at what's happened over the years for population. And yeah, fires too, same thing. Not all fires are created the same. There are some that are, they sterilize the soil, literally. And that will not be good for, could be 10 plus years. There are other ones where 2 years after the fire, it's insane food, insane growth. So definitely do your due diligence there too.
Yeah, I think you, well, it depends on how hot it burns, because how hot it burns, no matter how much rain you get, will take longer because it literally burns the seed bed. But even like a mild fire, if you got a drought already, like nothing's growing back until you get like a good year of rain. And it's going to take like 2-3 years before you get the kind of regrowth that people are talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's we learned that the hard way. The first day he was kicking himself, and then we tried to go back, and there was a guy that was like parked there, and you know, he's parked where you are, so you never know, did he go right or left off the road? And so we're like, well, we probably went right, because we want to go left, so logically he would have went right. Sure enough, he went left. We walked into like 100 yards behind him, and my buddy was an eastern whitetail hunter. He's never hunted the west before, and so I'm thinking, maybe the same as you're thinking, Ryan, like 100 yards from another hunter in the west is like a deal breaker, right? I'm not, like, he's here first. My buddy's like, well, let's just go over here, like 200 yards. I'm like, dude, this is like the west. Like, that guy's covering this whole ridge.
Yeah, I want to get away from him.
Yeah.
If he was there first, I want to get respect his space. But for my own personal, I do not want to be by you.
And
I don't want to trust that you're going to navigate terrain correctly, play winds right, blast correctly, trust that.
How mad you would be if you're hunting a ridge and some guy's like, oh, I'll just go 300 yards farther down the ridge. And so I'm like, no, we can't do it, man. Like, and he was pissed, like literally pissed at me. Like, I thought it was gonna get ugly, like just super angry. He's like, fine, F it, and just starts stomping back to the truck. And I'm like, oh boy, we got like 3 days left of this hunt. Like, this could go south real fast. By the time we got back to the camp and figured out a new plan, he's kind of over it. But he really was kicking himself for passing what he thought was not a good buck. Turns out it was the biggest buck we saw the whole trip.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you'll learn real quick the other way around when you get to a spot and you have it all to your own massive, you know, piece of public, and it all seems just magical. And then you realize it's like, okay, these are the type of things that I need to look for.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, Ryan, everyone that's ever hunted the West says, you know, don't pass on the first day what you would shoot on the last. Do you go by that, or do you go by more of a just whatever feels good on this day, I'm pulling the trigger?
I like to think that when I'm going into a unit, I understand what the unit is like. I definitely pay attention to that type of stuff. And I'm not one, I know the expectations for the unit. So I'll meet those expectations. But yeah, I would say, I mean, I take such short trips a lot of times. I try and maximize the amount of tags, but then I'm, you know, doing the stuff like driving through the night. So they ended up being short hunts. So maybe first day I'll let go of something that would meet my expectations for the unit, but you know, try and look for something second, third, fourth day. But usually by the second day, if it meets the unit's expectations, I'm pulling the trigger for sure.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, I hear that all the time, that whole phrase, like, don't pass something the first day that you shoot on the last, or vice versa. And for me, I'm like, dude, I don't think I've ever set that criteria so firm that I had to stick to it. You know what I mean? Like, if I get excited about something, I'm going to go after it. I'm going to try to make a shot on it. Or if it comes in to the tree stand and gets my heart pumping, I wholeheartedly, unless you're on managed private property, I wholeheartedly disagree with putting yourself in that box and potentially missing an opportunity, especially as a non-resident paying $500, $600, $700, $800 for a license. And then to be like, no, I said I wasn't going to shoot one like that, so I'm going to go home empty handed and kick myself for the next 350 days.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My brother,
yeah, you said it about the excitement part,
right? My brother's, he's a killer, man. He's like 4 for 7 on archery elk on public land, do it yourself, you know, general units. And he absolutely hates that saying. Like, he gets like passionate about how much he hates that saying. He's like, just shoot what makes you happy. Like, it doesn't have to be that hard. If it makes you happy today, shoot it. If it doesn't today but does tomorrow, shoot it. Like, just shoot what makes you happy. I'm like, dude, relax. Like, it's, you're not talking to me. Like, I get it.
No, dude, I'm on board with him.
Yeah, he's like, it doesn't have to be so hard. Just shoot what makes you happy when it makes you happy. Because we'll do it. Like you said, Ryan, you got to know what your unit you're in. Like, if when I drew the North Dakota tag, like, I knew I'm not shooting a 300-inch bull in the North Dakota elk tag. Like, the unit has 400s that are here every single year. I'm not shooting a 300. And I ended up right smack dab in the middle. But for, like, a general unit, I almost think, like, don't even look. Like, don't look up sizes. Don't put a number in your head. Just go out there, and when that elk or that mule deer is in front of you at 30 yards, just you'll know. You will know. Like Dan says, you're not going to be thinking about packing it out. You're not going to be thinking about whether you should shoot it. You'll know instantly. Like, your heart will be pumping, and if it is, you know you're shooting this animal.
Yep, exactly. It's called the general tag for a reason when you draw those ones. So
you can always hold out for a big one, but I've talked to other guys who have drawn tags, like moose tags and elk tags down in Arizona, in units that, like, are very highly coveted, and they don't pull the trigger on a bull, even though they would shoot it in any other place that they've ever hunted. And they're just like, oh, I just know. I know there's a bigger one. I know there's a bigger one. And then they end up shooting one that's 80 inches less on the final day because they, you know, there's definitely a bigger one. There's no guarantees. There really aren't. And I mean, I get it. Don't go out there and shoot a spike if that's something you don't want to do. But, like, if it gets your heart pumping and you have to talk yourself out of shooting it, you probably should just pull the trigger or punch the release.
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes it only takes a few hours to sort of get in the groove and understand the unit. Like, we had a Montana, well, the Montana big game combo. So we had the deer tag as well this year. And we ended up hunting a spot that the first spot we tried in, and it was the last weekend of the season. So they were actually starting to get to wintering grounds. Absolute insanity with numbers of deer. You know, first spot we checked out, there's, you know, a couple hundred that if we sitting on a glassing knob that we could see. And you see something like that, and it's like, okay, it's time to get selective. Because you always know that you can go back to some of these spots and get on that buck that you glassed up that first day. You know, some spots you can't do that. If it's treed in and stuff, and it's like, ah, I'm getting lucky that I'm even seeing this buck right now, maybe you should take the shot. But, you know, if you got confidence in some areas, you absolutely can have the confidence that you can go back and find the same animal that you saw on the first day and go back to it. So that's actually kind of fun when you can do that. Absolutely. And start to gauge what the unit has to offer and you know, just keep glassing.
Oh, Dan had a hunt like that this last year, man. He was giving me like every other day updates when he got cell service, but like the mule deer you guys were seeing in Utah just blew my mind. He's like, yeah, we saw this, there's this big 4x4 and there's this giant 3x3 and we saw all these bucks and we think we're gonna go after this other one we really like, but if we can't find him, there's, and I'm just like, I have never in my life had a mule deer hunt where I could judge a buck. It was like, there's a buck that's legal, I'm gonna shoot it.
Dude, we got into him, and I hope to get back out there this year. If not this year, I'll be out there every other year, because it's just, I've talked about it on the podcast a bunch, but it is this beautiful horseshoe shaped canyon that has trails that come into the mouth of it, and then they immediately go up over the wall, and they're just around the whole outside. Nobody hunts inside of it. And it's like all of the mule deer just funnel down in. They've got their little hidey holes, and we had 1.5 hours, we had 6 bedded buck encounters, all that I would have shot for sure. Like, no question about it. And unfortunately, we just couldn't quite get in range, or if we did get in range, didn't get a good shot opportunity. But it was lights out. I will not be giving those coordinates away anytime soon.
Dan's going to blindfold me and from like the Montana border and all the way through Wyoming and into Utah. I'll be blindfolded until we get to camp. Lock me in the back of his RV and just drive me out there.
Yeah, give me your phone. Yeah,
no, dude, no phone use for you this tranquilizer week. Dart, sedate you somehow.
Yeah, that's it's tough though because you got to really trust people when you're bringing them to your spots. You know, because anyone can pull out Onyx and just start putting pins down. And Dan and I talked about this just on the last podcast with Stephen Walker about shed hunting. You know, and we're talking about getting a trip planned with Steven today. We're going back and forth, like which week works for you. But it's like, he's going to be great enough to bring us out. Like you almost have to blacklist that spot. Like if you call Steven next year and say, hey, I'd love to get out again. Is it okay if we go? And he brings you, that's great. But to like go back to his spots without him. And that's just shed season. I mean, talk about like a trophy mule deer unit like you were in, Dan. Like it's so hard to know who you can trust to bring out.
I talked to an Alaska fishing guy, used him, and there was a client that came out, and he wasn't even trying to hide it. He pulled out his phone and had Onyx, and he was telling the fishing guy that he planned on coming back to the spot. He's like, yeah, we figured we'd come get some good intel and then come back the next day. And the fishing guide told him, he goes, put your phone away or it's going overboard. And the guy's like, oh, hold on just a second. Let me punch this in. And he continued to like try to save spots, and that Alaska fishing guide grabbed his phone and literally chucked it in the water. I mean, the guy never got his phone back, and the guide immediately drove back to shore and dropped him off.
Yeah, that's like to the point of arrogance. I mean, I think that's a thing for fishing guiding for sure, but under wraps. But yeah, that amount of arrogance, you almost get what you're coming through, for sure.
Yeah, I've never gotten burned by telling someone a spot, but I've also grown up, like my brother's more experienced than I am hunting the West and just hunting in general. And so I kind of just, you kind of grew up knowing like you don't want a big mouth when you're talking about hunting. You know, you don't want to tell people how like you got a monster buck on your farm, you know, because there's poaching, there's trespassing, people steal spots. And so I kind of always just had that like know-how in the back of my mind. Just watching him talk to people and just like, you don't want to overshare. Like if there's a friend or like someone's in dire need, like, yeah, we help, but you don't want to just like, hey, how's it going? Seen any elk? And then don't even let them respond. Be like, we saw a bunch of bulls on this spot the other day. And all of a sudden you're six trucks in your spot. You know, it's so hard to know to who to bring or who to talk to.
Yeah. Yeah. You almost got to phrase it at that point. It's like, the guys that ended up coming with you, and then you realize it's a good hunt. It's like, okay, this is, even if I might have found the spot, it's like, okay, this is our spot now. Like, you keep this on the wraps, you know I will, and the next time we come back, it's me and you. So even picking that first person to go on the hunt, it's someone that you'd want to go back there with if it ends up being good.
Yeah.
I mean, we had that this year for our rifle tag. We filled out the two that we didn't fill in archery. That spot was phenomenal. And it's like, I even have other people on my Onyx, and they're guys that I trust and hunt with, but I took those pins off of Onyx because, I mean, we share accounts or whatever. It's like, because it's me and this other guy's spot. We're going back, and I can't let anybody know, you know, a golden nugget like that. So,
dude, that's next level trust. Sharing an Onyx account?
Yeah.
I won't even share my Onyx account with my brother.
You want to know how tight-lipped Dan is? I didn't even know he had a brother.
There you go. Dan's brother probably got all the spots.
I'm just throwing you guys off my trail.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Sorry, can't go to that spot. It's kind of my brother's spot. You know, it doesn't even have a brother.
Exactly.
So, what's the plan this year? I mean, we're right in the middle of app season, Ryan. Unfortunately, Wyoming's already over, but Montana's coming right back up. You guys got plans again for this fall? You're going to try to hit up Montana again and draw the big game combo, or are you running short on points?
You got to split it up into the guaranteed stuff and then the hopeful stuff. No, I'm going to Colorado for deer this year. Really looking forward to that. I mean, mountain hunting mule deer doesn't get any better than that. And then Wyoming antelope, got a big crew going out there. South Dakota mule deer. So got some good guaranteed tags in there. And then, I'm throwing in for the Wyoming elk, at 4 points. We'll see about that. I mean, I don't think it's a secret anymore that, this year is going to be an interesting one for Wyoming elk. A lot of changes coming. So who knows? I don't know if everyone's going to be throwing in or people are going to be sitting on things, but, we'll see. It's a tag that I want, but, yeah, between that and then again, applying for, Montana with, 0 points, another,
you're doing the 0 points tip. 0 points. It's not subtle anymore. Go Hunt wrecked it for everyone.
Yeah, not everyone has a Go Hunt membership and not everybody looks at the regs, but yeah, I thought last year it'd be much better known, but the odds chart for Montana last year as far as like the 0-1-2 were almost identical.
Me and my brother, so we had 7 and Montana's party size is 5. Just who picks 5? But anyway, yeah. So we had to split our group up. So me and my brother went solo or as a team, tag team, and then the other 5 applied. And they had one guy that had a point, so they were at like a 0.2% average. 0.2 point average. Zero, they had a fifth of a point combined. And so they're like, well, we're screwed. Like, we're in no man's land. So we might as well do the point when you apply. And so they bought points and applied. Me and my brother went with the 0 point strategy. We all send in our stuff. The next day, Go Hunt releases the strategy article that talks about this whole thing. Anyway, me and my brother draw with 0. They don't draw with a 1.2 point average.
Yeah. I mean, that's... Yeah. You got to know that little tip in Montana. The year before, in the average points, that's when it was like some people would get it at 1, you're guaranteed at 2. I had 2 points, everybody else had the 1. All it took was like an inch above 1, and you got it. Well, this year it was like you got to have an inch above 2 to get it, you know, on your party size. So that's another tip too, for some of these states that do average points. Is even if you can't get a party together, but you're aware of the deadline, buy the point in some of these states, because then you'll get your other party members to, you know, start catching up or getting those points. And all it takes is one guy to have that extra point, and you put yourself above a ton of other people.
It's
another tip there.
I love how you brought that up, because me and our group literally had this exact same conversation, and it's kind of like beer goggles at the bar, right? Like certain people start looking a little bit more attractive later on in the evening after like 6 drinks, right? Certain people start looking like a better elk hunting partner when you find out they got 7 points in Wyoming. And
yeah,
we have a guy that's been year 1. He was slated to go. He was going to be a part of the original OG archery elk team, and he like blew his knee out. And ever since, for 7 years, it didn't work out, like schedules, group sizes. And so he's been building points in Wyoming this whole time, and he was supposed to be in our group. And now this year, we're like 1 point away. Like Ryan said, Wyoming's just a dumpster fire for trying to get non-resident tags. It's a great state, don't get me wrong. Great state, great elk. But the point creep is insane. It's on like a, it's on a interest growth track that I wish my 401k was on, because this thing is skyrocketing. Yeah. And so it's like, man, that other cat, he's starting to like look like a good addition to the elk group when he's going to have 8-9 points coming in.
Yeah. If you guys or anyone that, you know, has 3 antelope points in Wyoming, give me a call. Cause I got a group full of 2 and I'm doing my scouting and stuff. And it's like, yeah, we'll find a unit for sure at 2. But if you can get a hair above 2, opens up the
I happen to know a guy that's got 5.
Yeah, who's that?
Me. I got 5.
Ooh.
I got 5. My brother's got 7 or 8. He's been doing the North Dakota whitetail trick in Wyoming antelope for like 6 years. Second draw buck tags and keeping his points.
Okay. Yeah. He's got private land to hunt then.
He does. He does have private land to hunt. It's a unit that does have public, but it's not great. I don't know if we've ever seen an antelope on public.
Yeah, that's how Wyoming antelope is. I mean, the odds, that's the type of hunt where the odds don't lie. If you can pick the tag up on a second choice, there's a reason. Absolutely.
Yeah. So. They were driving around the first year. He let his daughter shoot first, my niece, and she shot, I think she did shoot her buck on public, but then there was like nothing. It was just bone dry. And they're driving around just looking for antelope. And my brother's looking at the map and like, no, we got to go here and we got to go there. And she's like, there's some antelope right there. And my brother's looking, he's like, oh, dude, that guy lives like right in this house right here, which isn't common out west. Like usually it's like some random state and there's no way you're going to track that person down. So he knocks on the door.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He's like, yeah, I suppose you guys could go out there and hunt antelope. And for 6 years, they've been hunting that same guy's ranch.
Yeah, having a kid helps.
The wingman, like the wingman strategy is where it's at. A good looking wife or a good looking lady with you or a child. And your odds of getting access go through the roof.
Well, as you know, that's kind of funny. I was just thinking about when Ryan was explaining his fall. Like, keep in mind, as busy as that sounds, the dude also is a waterfowl killer. So he's also adding probably equal number of days out in a duck blind or a goose spread. And so when you start talking about a wing woman with Ryan, you better pray to God, Ryan, you find someone that loves hunting as much as you, because the amount of days you spend out there are no other days for the summer vacation or a beach vacation or, you know, going off to doing this apple orchard tour in October. I mean, you better pray she loves hunting.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. There's no space.
Bit of resentment for the trips you've been on.
No.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's all cool. Yeah, you gotta think outside of the box. I'm actually, so I should add this in. I'm actually going to Hawaii next Thursday. People are like, oh, are you going with the family or the girlfriend? It's like, no, we're a couple of buddies. We're going out there hunting and fishing. So
doing the axis deer?
Not doing the axis. That'll be for next time. But we're going to the Big Island for turkeys and the sheep that they got there. So.
Nice.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
That's the kind of trip where you could bring your girlfriend, and then she'd be happy as a clam to just sit on the beach and drink Mai Tais while you're off arrowing hogs and javelinas.
Exactly.
That's my plan.
Exactly. Yeah, that's, I mean, I don't even care how this first trip goes, just learning how the system works, because Hawaii, I mean, everyone complains about certain states, like maybe Montana, about their licensing system. Hawaii is the Wild West. It's terrible. So figuring it out first, and then we'll worry about actually setting up a vacation with it. So
that kind of is a good point with the destination style hunts. Do you have certain sleeper states or certain trophy states that you're building points in and you don't even really apply or hunt, and then you're hunting these access tags in the meantime? I have a spreadsheet that I've shared with Dan, and he just was like, dude, you're ridiculous. Such an engineer.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Oh, I'm the same way. I manage a lot of people's points and like that type of thing on spreadsheets for sure. But no, I would say, I mean, all the states that I currently put in for, I'm expecting to hunt, you know, here and there. I mean, as far as sleeper states, they're really, it's harder to find them anymore as sleeper states, because you could talk about like building points in like a Washington or an Oregon. Wouldn't recommend it really, I guess. Arizona, it's like everyone kind of understands what they're getting into. It's a long points game. You don't, especially being from North Dakota, I'm not gonna draw an access tag in Arizona. I have to pass through a bunch of other good hunting on that 24-hour drive to get down there. You know, that's kind of not in the focus, but New Mexico definitely is. I'll be putting in for several New Mexico species just because it's actually pretty economical to do so in a way. It's actually probably a per species basis. It's, if you're going to put in for a few species, it's cheaper than most other Western states. You just got to upfront the tag costs. So if you're trying to go after oryx and ibex and elk and all that, it's like you better be okay with being down a couple few grand for a couple months. So,
and talk about a
that's sleeper.
Talk about a calendar breaker. New Mexico, because you can't plan on anything. There's no point system. Yep. There's no analytics. You're putting in, but you're planning on, most of the time you're planning on not drawing. And you're swinging for the fences. But in the meantime, you got to plan the rest of your fall. We're going to go elk hunting in Montana, do all these other things. And then all of a sudden you get an email from the New Mexico Game and Fish that you drew this once in a lifetime elk tag, and the whole calendar just goes out the window.
Yep. Yep. But worth it.
Worth it. Yeah. Worth it. I've got a sleeper.
If you plan it right.
Yeah. If you plan it right. If you pick the right unit, like you're not going to do the 40% unit New Mexico because it's just not worth the stress of trying to plan around for what you're getting in a tag from this far away from North Dakota, right? If you live in Arizona, go for it. Hunt it on the weekends. But yep. No, I got a sleeper. I got a sleeper state that I'm building points in. And when I say sleeper state, I'm talking like roofies sleeper, like this state. I'm building points in Utah, which is like a 30-year program. So,
yeah, that's a tough one. I was surprised to hear, Dan, that you had gotten in on a tag. I missed that. Was that an archery or a rifle tag?
That was an archery tag, and I didn't even put in my friend Linnea. She had just got a bow and had been practicing all summer. Messed up her shoulder, so she had a drop in poundage, screwed, like, didn't feel confident out to certain ranges, but she put in with 0 points and got a tag. And it's an area that's really well known for elk, and we did run into a lot of elk hunters, but we just went out there, got, I bet you we had a dozen plus encounters inside of 70 yards with big bucks. And she even, first time ever hunting, and I think this is our second day seeing mature deer, and she stalked one into 15 yards and she drew back, got up from her knees, and there was a log in between her and the deer, and when she stood up, all she could still see was the head, ears, and antlers, and had no shot, and it went straight from bedded to a full sprint. But I bet you, in addition to those closer encounters, we probably doubled or tripled that in sightings within 300 yards of big bucks.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's wild. I believe it.
I'm trying to hunt some good bucks. I'm trying to hunt elk in the Boulder unit or the Dutton unit, which is like right now it's at 25 points to draw. I got a 0.4% chance. I'd love to go with Ryan Carter from DC Jeez. Outfitters. I think the dude trail cameras more 400 inch bulls than anyone I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, I've seen that. Not anymore, though.
Yeah. Utah's maybe. Yeah, Utah's playing a little fast and loose with the laws coming out of Congress on hunting rights. They got the trail camera ban. Now they're doing the sheds closure. Utah's getting a little feisty over there. You're going to have have some people cussing for the first time in their lives over in Utah.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah, they've always been kind of a... they're a little sketchy about land type stuff over there.
Utah's a state that has, like, out of all the states, and there's exceptions everywhere, but it seems like the hunters in Utah have a passion and a drive that is unparalleled in most other places. Like the guys that run in trail cameras or the shed hunters or the elk hunter, like these dudes are on another level. It seems like every big shed hunter is from Utah. Seems like all of these like 400 inch guides are all in like Utah. Utah is just a wild state.
It is.
Yep.
So.
Yeah. It's not one that I apply for right now. I look at those odds and it's like, and again, I have to drive through so much other good hunting. And I mean, I got like the Dakotas and in Montana to look forward to that.
Yeah.
Great tag picker uppers. So
I hear you. Yeah, I always try to get the access tags and sleep on the limited entry options down the road. But yeah, it is what it is. It's just hunting.
Yeah,
I am curious to see what these different, like what all these eastern states and Midwest states that are picking up elk or having elk reintroductions starting to open up seasons. I'm curious to see how that's going to play into Western access and tags and availability and draw odds, because really, realistically, I think in the next 20 years, we're going to see another dozen states that open up elk seasons, and they might not be for non-residents, but it gives the residents an option to go and hunt there instead of travel all the way out west.
Yeah, it definitely could. I've always thought about just like, how big are those herds going to get before the local farmers and the local egg community starts to like push back and be like, hey, elk are cool, but I still have to make a living. Cause we see that a lot in North Dakota. Like that's the number one limiting factor on the North Dakota herd, is ranchers don't want any more elk. And so we don't even have a sustainable herd to open up non-resident hunting. The only way you can hunt elk in North Dakota as a non-resident is to buy the auction tag or win a raffle tag.
Dang.
Yeah, I kind of wonder, like, the local guys that get drawn in, like, Missouri, they might not go out west that year, but, yeah, just kind of curious, like, how it's going to happen, because there's so much population on the east. You know, where are these elk going to go live?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, Appalachia is the place they're looking into, and rightfully so, you know, less ag to get into there.
Yeah.
It's definitely something I've thought about. I mean, Kentucky has done a heck of a job getting their herd up and going. I've thought about throwing in for that one too. So it's kind of, you know, could go the other way around too. It's like, I'm a guy that has pretty decent access to the West. I'm not coming from all the way out. I just, like, I'm getting an elk tag, you know, every year. And now I'm thinking about going to, or at least applying for Kentucky. So it's like, it might go the other way around too. It's like, people think like that would be super cool to hunt elk in the Appalachians. Might as well try it. So
I think Randy Newberg just did a giveaway with Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation for the Kentucky elk tag, and guided by Randy. And I'm like, that would be sweet. But I've heard some nasty stuff about the Kentucky. Like we think some of the stuff we hunt is steep and gnarly. Like some of those mountains are pretty nuts.
Yeah. And
a
jungle too.
So awesome, man. Well, Ryan, we're coming up on an hour 15 already. Man, time has flown by. Dan and I have this problem every time we start talking about hunting. It's like, dude, half the day just went by.
Time. Who doesn't?
Yeah, dude. But it's awesome to kind of hear your take on like the Western whitetail and the, you know, coming from a flatland background and then diving into all these different opportunities. I mean, that's what the podcast is really about, is just truly how many opportunities are west of the Missouri.
Yep.
So awesome. Well,
yeah, absolutely.
Appreciate you being here, bud. Appreciate you getting the chance to meet Dan, the original OG host. And
yeah, thanks for hopping on, man.
Yeah, absolutely. Blast talking to you guys, and I've never passed up an opportunity to do that. So
yeah, anytime you want to come out and call for us, Dan and I'll gladly take you up on the hour. You might, like, we won't even be mad if it takes you till like 10:30, 11 in the morning to call in our bulls. We're fine with it. We're not too picky.
I love calling.
I wish I could do like praise hands emoji on the podcast. I don't think that's possible, but yeah.
Yeah, definitely. The listeners definitely wouldn't get it, but yeah, that's nuts. No. So awesome. Thanks for being here, buddy. And thanks for listening, folks.